This is Nala Hopkinson.
And Jeff Ryman.
And you're listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, episode 58.
I love it.
Bringing you authors of science fiction and fantasy, publishing industry analysis, writing tips, book reviews, and the occasional belly laugh.
World while you were gone.
Nice segue there, Sean.
It's Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
This is Hugo and Nebula Award-winning author Robert J. Sawyer.
And now, streaming from the Singularity Audio Studios in San Diego, California, your hosts. Welcome to another episode of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. Today's episode is brought to you by two fine novels, Reading the Wind by Brenda Cooper and Bones Burnt Black by Stephen Ewan Cobb. Visit our website to learn more about these science fiction thrillers. Now today we have our last interview with the instructors of Clarion. Both Nalo Hopkinson and Jeff Ryman join us. And I'm hoping to get together with the students this week. I didn't think my schedule was going to work out, but it looks like it will. So right now I'm on to get together with them.
Yeah, excellent.
That'd be cool. Oh yeah, Sam's back with us. Hi, Sam.
Hi, guys. I'm no longer drunk and or hungover, so I'm back on the show.
It took 2 weeks.
My liver hates me.
Yeah, I forgot to introduce us at the beginning. I totally missed that.
Tool.
My name's Sean, by the way.
And I'm Sam.
Yeah, there we go.
Because you didn't know that.
So hopefully this Friday I'll be getting together with them, and it's going to be real interesting to hear about their experience, and quite entertaining. They were a very vibrant and energetic bunch when I had dinner with them last Friday.
Which is shocking, because they've just been put through hell, you know, late nights,
you know,
writing and...
But have you ever had those late nights where you're exhausted, but everything is hysterical, and you're like running around?
So you're saying they're slap happy.
That was, yeah, it was borderline slap
happy. That must have been a fun night.
It was quite entertaining. I kind of sat back and just enjoyed myself. In this show, we also have some feedback to get to, some publishing news, and the third key in the Keys to Publishing contest, where you can win free books. More on that later. But first, Sam, why don't you give us your 3-minute highlight of Comic-Con? Yes, I'm giving you a time limit, as they've already heard what I've done. So tell us what you did while you were there.
Well, you know how I have my verbal diarrhea. So yes, timeline, always good for me.
156.
Thank you. I have two words for you. Partay. And also three words. After partays. I actually did not see much of Comic-Con this year. It was so crowded.
I know.
I wasn't able to get into any of the panels that I wanted without lining up like 8 hours in advance. And mm-hmm. I kind of just refused to do that. So I walked the dealer's room floor, saw lots of great costumes, always excellent. I got hugged by Chewie. Chewbacca hugged me.
A costume Chewbacca or actually?
No, he's one of the three, I guess there are three like official Chewbaccas with the official Chewbacca costumes, not just like a cheesy costume you can
with
rent.
With one of the Star Wars
With the voice
groups.
Box and with one of the Star Wars groups. Like you have to go through Lucas. It's like some crazy thing you have to do to get authenticated. So yeah, it wasn't Peter Mayhew, though I met him last year, but it was a costume Chewbacca who hugged me and we took pictures. It was excellent.
That's cool.
And let's see, what else? Oh yeah, so that's what I did. And I one thing I love about con, after parties. There are so many great parties. So I went to the G4 party. I went to the party that some friends of mine host every year. We started out as this little thing in people's backyards many years ago, and now it's Comic-Con's largest after party. We had about 900 people there.
Ooh.
And it was great. The music was fabulous. Got to see my friend Richard from New Zealand.
Is that the one that was on the ship last year?
Yeah, that's our Halloween party. Halloween parties are usually a lot smaller. The Comic-Con party is the biggest one.
Oh, okay.
For sure. But
okay.
It's called Exanguin. So those of you who have been to the party, hi, I'm one of the people that throw it. Now you know me doubly or something. Probably saw me dancing.
They're going to get you now.
Yeah. I know. Please don't post embarrassing pictures of me on the internet. Because I'm sure there are many.
So what did you dress up as?
I dressed up as Agent Spalko from the latest Indiana Jones movie, which not the best movie in the world, but Cate Blanchett is awesome, and I thought she was a great villainess. Plus, it was just a cool costume.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I had that made for me. And it was interesting who recognized it and who didn't. I actually had more kids recognizing it than adults and kids wanting to take their pictures with me.
Really?
Including an adorable, like, 7-year-old kid dressed up as Indiana Jones.
Oh, very cool.
Who was all shy and kind of afraid of me, but he wanted his picture anyway, so.
Well, yeah, you're like 6'5".
Yeah, exactly.
And you're probably wearing
heels. And then I was using, you know, my sad fake Russian accent, you know, to beckon him over. And he's like, oh my God, Agent Spalko will murder me in my sleep. And, you know, bar I was drinking at, Bruce Campbell was there. And it's just, that's the great thing about Comic-Con. You never know who you're going to bump into, who you're going to see. People from all around the world congregating, you know, friends you hardly ever get to see. And that's what I did. I barely went to bed before dawn almost every night. So that was a...
I wasn't up that late. Yeah. 2 a.m. was the latest I was there because I had to drive back to Poway each night. So...
Yeah.
And then get there early, so I'm only getting 5 hours, 4 or 5 hours of sleep each night. My random encounters in the bathroom were with Tim Russ, Tuvok from Voyager. He was not very pleased. I didn't talk to him.
Really?
The look on his face, there must have been a look of recognition in my eye when
we
made eye contact.
Weird. The fact that he'd be pissed about that. These are your fans.
Well, you know, I have no idea what his day was. You know, I don't want to make any assumptions.
Day. Sure.
But I just thought
he
wanted to be.
Or maybe he's just a jerk.
Or maybe people come up to him and talk to him when he's trying to pee. I mean, hello?
I know. I'm kidding. That comment was a joke.
Yeah. Which I wasn't going to do. I was going to give him peace. And then the other random bathroom
offer
encounter.
To shake it for him. Can I help you with that?
So it's true what they say about Vulcans. Milo, whatever his name is, from Heroes.
Oh, okay.
Who plays Petrelli. You know who I'm talking about. I saw him in the bathroom, and we did talk, and he was very nice. And then I realized why there were 5 guards waiting outside the bathroom. They were escorting him down the hall.
Makes
so
sense.
He wouldn't
being
get
fan mobbed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently, Captain Tightpants from Firefly, I guess, was just wandering around the dealer's room floor kind of incognito.
Nathan Fillion was walking around. Yeah. I saw a picture of him online. He was taking pictures with people in costumes.
Wow. That's awesome.
So, yeah. Yeah. And he had a big old cowboy hat on. So if you weren't really paying attention to him, then
you wouldn't notice it
was
him.
Walk right by him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I didn't see him. Bummer.
Yeah, that would have been cool. I saw Casper Van Dien in the hallway.
Oh, you did?
We talked for a
second.
How does
he look?
He looked good.
Yeah, I bet. Probably. Movie star that he is.
Yeah, he had a really nice suit on. You know, he was...
He was prepped. To... Not haggard, not hungover.
No.
Like many of us were.
So if you want to know more about our Comic-Con experience, there is a report up on the website, and Sam is going to send me more of her time there with a few pictures, hopefully.
More embarrassing photos, yes.
Yeah, so we'll put those up with mine if you want to read about everything that I did there. Come check it out. And if you went to Comic-Con, we would love to get your story just posted on the blog. Put a couple of paragraphs on there about what you did and who you saw. I think it'd be fun to kind of see what the Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing community was doing at Comic-Con.
That
I know
would be
some
really
of you
cool,
were there.
Actually. I would love that. And I would love, I don't think I met anyone who listened to us, but it would be so great if, you know, any accidental Sam and Sean sightings, if you posted those.
Yeah, that would be kind of random. I met a couple of people.
Did
who,
you?
Yeah, who, they were both, they're both editors.
Oh,
with
cool.
Major houses. I didn't know they listened to us, and they do.
Very, very
so
cool.
That was cool, yeah. Enough about Comic-Con, though. I want to get in this publishing news story before we move on with our interviews, because it's something that we brought up, I can't remember when, I think it was at the beginning of the year we brought this up in publishing news.
It's been 5 minutes, I've forgotten.
You've forgotten about the story?
No, I've just, you know, that's a joke about my memory. I don't remember when, it was a while ago,
yeah.
I would say about that.
It's been more, you said 5 months or 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Okay, well, it's been
I have to write
a lot more.
Down.
Yeah. All right. We had reported that Wizards of the Coast was launching a new imprint called Discoveries. And this imprint was to feature, you know, new worlds, new talent, and new voices for the adult fiction market. But they are already going to close the imprint down and instead pour their efforts into their D&D properties. So anything on this schedule for 2009 is going to be removed. And they're still going to finish out the 2008 schedule. So, I mean, I don't know the story behind all of this, but it's only been 7 or 8 months, I believe, since this imprint debuted. So it doesn't sound like they gave it much of a chance. I mean, the books just must not have been doing well. Or who knows what's going on with Wizards of the Coast when you think about the stuff that Tracy Hickman told us about in episode 44.
It seems to me this is complete conjecture on my part, but there's some chaos happening on the inner workings of Wizards of the Coast, just from some of the stories I've been hearing lately, like what happened to Tracy Hickman and Margaret Weiss. And now this did not last very long. And
no.
I mean, as you said, they did not give it much of a chance. So I'm not really sure what's going on with them. It's some shakeup. Like they're not sure where their priorities are right now. And what they should focus on.
It appears that way. I mean, of course, we have no idea what's going on behind the scenes.
I have
no
insider, you know, feeding
me. Yeah, as you said, it's all conjecture.
Information, but yeah.
And I do feel bad for the authors whose books are still coming out in this imprint for the rest of this year, because you can pretty much be guaranteed that your book's not going to be giving publicity.
Heck
you
yeah.
know, I mean, yeah. It might be printed, but they're not going to do anything with it. Why would they? The imprint's going away.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
That kind of stinks. Like, oh, I got a professional book coming out, but, you know, 6 months from now, it's going to be gone, most likely.
That's called a buzzkill.
Total buzzkill.
Yep.
So that's all the story that we have for publishing news. But I wanted to follow up on it since we had talked about it before. Okay, let's take a break, and we will come back with Nalo Hopkinson and Jeff Ryman. What if you got your heart's desire to fly a spaceship? What if you could go to the planet you've always dreamed of, where people like you came from, and where you were no longer considered a freak? My name is Joseph, and I got both of those dreams. Good dreams can turn to nightmares, and the future is not what we expect. On our approach to Silver's home, we were warned away. I had to find the resources to land safely, in spite of the fact I had never landed. The spaceport was closed, and the authorities might start shooting us as we defied them. And then I found a man in the ship's data, like myself, who could read the wind of data. And he had instructions to keep us from landing. Reading the Wind continues Brenda Cooper's saga of the Silver Ship. Visit the Five Worlds and return to Fremont. See what happens when multiple societies clash. Feel what it means to be human. Lose yourself in a story of suspense, love, and mind-blowing science fiction. Find Reading the Wind in bookstores everywhere and visit brenda-cooper.com to learn more about the novel and the author. All right, welcome back to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. And I'm here at Clarion once again, probably for the final Clarion episode. We'll see, there might be one more. And I'm joined by not one, but two authors this time, Nalo Hopkinson and Jeff Ryman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I want to start off by asking you how the week's going. I know, unlike most instructors, you guys are here for 2 weeks, so even less sleep than what everyone else has been getting. So tell us what the week's been like.
Even more or less sleep is what it is. I have taught Clarion before. I've taught all three of them. I've done the Clarion hat trick, East, when it was East, West, and Clarion South in Brisbane.
Oh, cool.
But this is the first time I've done the two-week sort of anchor.
Yeah.
So it's been getting used to what the sort of culture of Clarion is now that it's moved to UC San Diego, and meeting students whose work we read because we were part of the committee that picked them.
Mm-hmm.
Coming in when they've already been getting to know each other and working together for you know, 4 weeks, and here we are, and we're the greenhorns.
It's interesting. I mean, each Clarion does have a slightly different flavor, and this one has developed a flavor of its own pretty quickly, I think. Different from the previous Clarion at Lansing. And that's a battery.
Sorry. It's felt a slightly different culture.
It's a good one. It's a culture in which I think the students are very much center. And I think being in San Diego, which is such a center for science and for science fiction writing, the guest list, in addition to the teachers, is phenomenal. This afternoon we had Verna Vinge. Last week we had Scott McCloud on comics, David Brin, Neil Gaiman reading, of course, he was the instructor. We had Patrick Nielsen Hayden.
Because he was here for Comic-Con.
Yeah, yes. And he was there to talk about publishing to the writers. And then, because it's Neil, Dave McKean popped in for Saturday night.
Oh, so
it's,
wow.
And the whole, I think San Diego is somehow with all its sciences and its history of, you know, because Werner Vinge taught here and Kim Stanley Robinson went here. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an SF center, and I think that colors it. And then being here during Comic-Con, it's less of a sort of secluded place where writers go into a boot camp for writers, and more like an ongoing rolling Chautauqua on science fiction.
So we got a pretty exhausted bunch is what we got.
Now, do you know if anyone went to Comic-Con? Any of the students? They all went. Oh,
yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah, several expeditions full in various battalions and cars. I went to, before I started teaching, I haven't seen a Comic-Con before, and it was overwhelming. I mean, we went in, and I saw all these people sitting down, slumped on the floor, and I said, come on, guys, you're at a con, get with it. And 3 hours later, I was slumped on the floor, looking dazed. I mean, that hall was so big, I actually didn't find the Marvel stand.
Have you been to Comic-Con before, Nala?
Yes, a few years ago, so I knew what I was missing, and that was not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. 3 football fields? That's the size of the stand? Yeah.
It could be, yeah.
It's huge. It's just, it's overwhelming.
That's the dealer's room.
Yeah. Yeah, the dealer's room is out of control. I mean, I went on preview night just to get my pass.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, oh, it's preview night. I'll be better. 70,000 people, I'm guessing. I was literally stuck shoulder to shoulder in the middle of the dealer's room, and I couldn't move. Not a pleasant experience.
Yeah.
Jeff, have you taught Clarion before?
Oh, loads of times. I don't know. I've lost count. I haven't done Australia, but I did Clarion West and Clarion lots of times. And it's just, it's a format that works. And they now know with the pedagogical research why it works.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at a lot of different kinds of skill training, including teaching languages as a profession, peer critiquing is absolutely core to how you learn. And that's one of the cornerstones of this. And then applying it while you're doing the peer critiquing. So this is boot camp for writers. You're writing, you're having to do the critiques. I don't know how they do it. They read 4 short stories in a day, and they have to write 1 a week. And it's just, you know, you come out of it. I think it's a life-changing experience for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certainly was for me as a Clarion grad. So it's interesting to see, to be on this side of it, having been to Clarion, and then coming back as an instructor, seeing the differences in my own mindset and how things have changed, and remembering what it was like to be that person where, you know, someone said, oh, I didn't understand why you put an adjective here, and you thought, I suck.
Now, Neil told me last week, I can't remember if he told me this while we're recording, if it was off the record. Well, the essence of it was that Clarion's a very emotional experience. It was, Jeff, what you just hinted at. Now, thinking back to when you were there, how do you get through it when you get into this last week or two?
It helps if the group of students, you've built some kind of core of respect and trust, because there will be irritations. You're reading each other's work. It is very personal. Essentially, that story enters your head and you're reading it. It's like it's coming, the voice is coming from you, and it's doing things that you think don't work. So people get irritated. Personal stuff comes up, no matter if you're writing, you know, the futurist science fiction. There is a level of personal input. Things get very vulnerable. And so being able to... you're not going to like everybody. There's no way that you can like everybody that you're you know, sequestered here for 6 weeks with. But building that gestalt, that respect and that trust is, I think... vital to it, and this year's students have done so amazingly.
I think what I've noticed is, I think it's a cultural shift. I think just in general, a lot of the things you were talking about are kind of passed much more into the culture as a whole and seem a little bit more readily available. People just seem... The first one I did was in 1993, and I think people just have much more skills available to draw on. They seem to have a vocabulary. They just seem to do it better.
Interesting.
There's much less of the I'm a romantic rock god going to be a writer. There's much less of I'm a geeky genius. There's much less of some of the stuff that you used to get. And I think I do think that it's a measure of culture change in the culture as a whole, really.
Do you think they have a better work ethic? Is that part of what you're saying or hinting at? Or
no, I think they just know how to resolve conflict better.
Okay.
Okay. And it's more, there's been more written about it. There's more, it might be all those dumb self-development books and courses we've all been on. I do think that just people come to this kind of thing with a greater degree of awareness. When I did my first one, it was the era of grunge. People became very romantic. They came very outspoken in a way that wasn't always very helpful sometimes. Hmm.
Yeah, I think it is a cultural change. I think you're right. And I think we have built it by coming out there talking about our experiences. And I know one of the things that I have done that I started doing at Clarion West when I was teaching there is there's a letter that I wrote that was an open letter to the students, because what happens is so many of us who love science fiction and fantasy, we are the outsiders. We are the ones who get, you know, we're the 100-pound weaklings. We're used to being made fun of. We're used to being on the outside. You come to something like this, and all of a sudden, if it's working, you're with people who, for the first time, you're at the top of the heap.
Yeah.
And it's easy to replicate the same kind of group cliquishness and you know, putting people on the outs, and that has happened to us. So one thing I have started doing is just to tell students to be aware of that, to not let people get isolated, to not take the one different person and, you know, be a little groups whispering about them, to make an effort. And that's, Clarion students are a smart bunch. That's really, I think, most of what it's taken is to let them know, to be aware that there's a problem, and people have been rising to the occasion.
Cool. It reminds me of something that Kim Stanley Robinson said when he was in San Diego. I guess, gosh, this was a year and a half ago when his last book came out. And he was talking about the science fiction community and saying that science fiction is something that welcomes everyone in, you know, and there shouldn't be anyone who's marginalized in science fiction.
It welcomes them in if their face fits. I think there's some structural issues, which maybe we'll get to later, but there was a remarkable article in Strange Horizons a couple of months ago, and I can't remember the woman who wrote it. A really fine piece of objective research. She just went through and found out the percentage of stories in the 1930s that were being published by women.
Yeah.
And not surprisingly, the percentage in the 1930s and now is the same.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's inclusive, and yes, if you're a like-minded person, you fit in, and I'd say both Nalo and I do. But, you know, it's not always everybody's experience, and I think one of the things this Clarion seems to have done well is try and send out some reassuring messages at the recruitment stage about the inclusiveness of the Clarion, and I think we have to keep getting those messages out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in science fiction community is inclusive, but sometimes the way that inclusivity works is you include everybody by never talking about difference, and because that's seen as singling people out. If you come from some kind of marginalized group, it is vital to you to be able to talk about that difference. And silencing it, well, you become the problem. If you talk about, I don't know, ableism, you become the problem because you're making an issue of it.
Right.
And I see that happen all the time, that kind of silencing. And we need to get smarter, and we are getting smarter as a community about recognizing that there are ways of doing inclusivity that doesn't impose yet another standard to meet, because it's not inclusive inclusivity. See what I mean?
Yeah, but oh, go ahead, Jeff.
It's kind of mirrored if you're not looking at the literary or the kind of books that people here like, and the graphic novels they like, and the writers they like. But if you look at something like Star Trek and the whole mass market science fiction, what you'll see is there's a kind of inclusiveness. They'll have one black person and one Japanese person, but you won't ever see them talking to another black person or another Japanese person, and they're all thoroughly assimilated into the culture of the starship.
Right.
And it's an odd inclusivity that sometimes you feel it's more like assimilation than something that allows a space for genuine cultural difference. And I'm not saying that's science fiction at all, but it's the difference between that balancing act where you're aware of the differences and aware of the history, and people are allowed to be different, and the kind of environment you sometimes get when you have that kind of official 1940s bomber crew image of the future we'd all like to live in.
Do you think some of this that we're talking about here in science fiction is reflective of postmodern culture, which blends different cultures together in sort of this strange American oneness? You know, I think about just traveling across the United States, you know, it, all the shopping centers look the same no matter where you are. It's like you're always in the same place. And is that part of that being reflected in science fiction?
I think inevitably, since this is America, and the great story of America is everybody comes here and everybody comes American. And maybe it's a good thing in some ways. Certainly, Britain is remarkably, that's where I live, is remarkably diverse too. London Borough of Camden, there's 132 languages spoken. But what seems to happen is you'll get the Polish center and the Polish bookshop and the Polish supermarket. You'll get an area of town that's Turkish. You'll get one area of town that's Bengali, another area of town that's much more likely to be Hindu and Indian. And that model of everyone becoming American is maybe something they're trying to establish in Britain, maybe not. And there's a debate going on around that now. Do you want everyone just to become English? Right. Or can you live with very separate cultures just being separate?
Yeah, and I'm from Canada, so we get to very directly contrast the whole melting pot idea against government policy of multiculturalism that has its own issues, but that means that you do not have to give up where what you come from in order to be Canadian. And I see definite advantages to that. It is difficult. You need to be able to hold more than one idea in your head about what it means to be a Canadian. It can mean identity issues that you hear a lot of Canadians saying we have no identity. Whereas for me, coming to Canada as an immigrant, as I did, they're very much our Canadian identities. And they're evolving, and it's complicated, and you cannot summarize it in a sentence. So, yes, very much what I see in science fiction, fantasy culture is reflective of what I see in the larger community from which that science fiction comes. As much as we like to think of ourselves as being apart from some of the more difficult or small-minded parts of our society, we are part of the society.
Right.
It's just natural that some of the same shortcomings would be reflected. I don't think that redounds especially on science fiction and fantasy. I don't think that means there's necessarily a bigger problem with us than, you know, anybody else. I think it's all part of a larger culture in which these things happen.
Jeff, you were nodding your head there. Just something you wanted to add?
Not to single Canada or Britain out. I don't think it's an issue of the, you know, the individual, really. All of those countries have legacies that are very difficult to shift. And I don't think it's now a question of individual people who have ill will. It's more a question of these legacies which just don't seem to shift. I mean, you could not find a group of people, I think, who are more aware of, let's say, issues of gender, issues of what used to be called feminism. They're very aware of it. And yet, you know, we still have one-third of the stories by women, two-thirds by men. And it doesn't seem to shift. And it's very difficult to get a hold on that kind of structural problem, because it is curiously resistant to the individual will of the individual people involved, and even, curiously enough, the collective will. I mean, there's enormous will among science fiction too. These are people who want to live in the future, in a good future. So they're wanting to get into all sorts of interesting new social relations, and yet even this field can sometimes seem to be moving very slowly, and it's structural, and it's very hard. I don't understand it.
Well, I think it's hard to shift because it is structural, but we're told it's individual. So someone says something that you think is racist, the problem is them, they're, you know, and it's more complicated than that. The problem is a society where there's a whole lot of people's ideas to change, and there's a whole infrastructure that's been supporting attitudes that keep that thing going, and the infrastructure is very, very difficult. It's its own juggernaut. So while we keep that idea in our heads that we're going to, you know, hold up individual people and blame them, I don't think we can get change.
And it's very difficult to get perspective on this. I mean, I write a lot about Cambodia, and a lot of people have raised issues in my work about cultural appropriation. I mean, why are you writing about Cambodia? How can you, as a Westerner, write about it? And I actually find that kind of dismaying, because as far as I'm concerned, I want to write. I don't want to write in a box about white people.
Yeah.
I want to, and particularly in Cambodia, for some reason, Cambodia for me is a way. I can't write about every country in the world. I can't learn all those languages. I can't get hold of all those histories. But Cambodia becomes one tiny corner of the world that is not, you know, doesn't have a veto in the UN, and sort of open it up and bring it back. And it's that kind of is what drives my work. And yet I can see that to some people, you know, this is just someone moving in on someone else's story, and it's an interesting tension for me sometimes, let's put it that way.
One of the things that Marianne was talking about is, and she says she sees a lot in fiction in the field, is the sort of cliche nondescript white male protagonist who just doesn't really seem to have a background, doesn't have any kind of ethnic identity, it's just this white dude doing stuff. What is your take on that, and what do we need to do to start bringing out the ethnic identity of all the characters, but even the white guys who do have backgrounds and
oh yes. Yes, the white guys do have backgrounds and cultures, and it gets on my last nerve when someone says to me, but I have no culture, particularly if, I don't know, I'm looking at somebody white European and I think I'm reading fantasy. I'm reading the stories that went into building your culture. Don't tell me you don't have any culture.
Yeah.
I think science fiction and fantasy are very well set up to do this kind of examining expectations. And it happens. It does happen. And I cherish that work. Even there's Neil Gaiman, his novel Anansi Boys,
mm-hmm.
where those characters, most of the main characters are black. And what he did was, the only time for the most part he mentions the race of a character is if they're not black, which is a very interesting experiment, because often that would be how black folks would talk to each other. You say, oh, you know, that white guy down the road, because you don't need to say that black woman over there. And for him to like turn it on its ear, it's very, very subtle.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is how few readers realized that most of the characters were black. And the god Anansi is one of the main characters, comes from West Africa. We're doing things that are thought experiments to some extent. For some of us, it's a lived experiment of saying, how do we examine that notion that there's such a thing as having no culture? Yeah, you didn't see my face there. Yeah.
Well, I could. Sorry, folks.
I think there's a great advantage, though, to the blank slate. America has a great advantage culturally in that it has established itself as a universal venue for all kinds of stories. You can tell a story about a shy American, an aggressive American, a quite sweet guy living on a houseboat, any kind of story from action to rom-com. If you're in a country with a very strong national identity, but it hasn't established itself as a universal venue for stories, let's say like Brazil, you're likely to be trapped making a movie. If you want internet, you know, if it's part of the identity of Brazil, it will be about favela violence. It might be about football. It might be set in carnival. But it must draw on the very few things that are universally acknowledged in that culture.
Right.
For it to find an audience. Britain, it's got to be about royalty or before 1945. And that is a great advantage for American culture, in that you've managed to universalize yourselves in a funny kind of way. And, you know, you can go to Syria and they will be watching American movies.
Right.
Yeah, the disadvantage is that happens. You go to Syria, they're watching American movies, and so you think, it becomes invisible because you're soaking in it. See, that's where that lie about I have no culture comes. It's, well, it's most powerful nation on the earth. Its culture is replicated pretty much right across the world now, but it's there. And ask anyone who's not from here, and they can tell you some of the signifiers of American culture.
Yeah, what's disturbing about that to me is I see very few movies that reflect what my life is like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all these people around the world who have never been to America getting these Hollywood ideas of all of us running around shooting guns, blowing things up, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Seems like every movie that comes out nowadays about some guy blowing things up.
Yeah.
But
and that's got something to do, too, with the needs of those viewers, because those movies are now made with a view to the international market as much as the, you know, especially action movies, because they translate particularly well around the world. So that's to do with all sorts of processes.
I want to break topic for a second here and talk about what you are currently working on. Now that I saw on your website that you had a couple books that you're writing this year, can you tell us about those books?
Well, I have the book that was due last year that isn't quite done yet, Blackheart Man, which is sort of an alternate history fantasy. And I'm working on two more that are due this year. One is adult contemporary fantasy. The other is a young adult fantasy.
Those are Taint and Once?
Taint and actually not Once anymore. But
no.
It something else started, you know, coming out when I started typing. And right now I'm calling it either Storm Clouds or Donkey, depending on what day it is and, you know, what showed up in the plot.
Cool. And Jeff, what about you?
I've got a book coming out very shortly in the States called The King's Last Song, and that's my big book on Cambodia. It's one half set in the Angkor Wat era. It's the life story of Cambodia's greatest king. He's written a book on gold about his life, and that book shows up in 2004, linking it to a contemporary story about modern Cambodia. Now it's still getting over various traumas.
Okay.
And I'm also pulling together an anthology in Britain of writers who collaborate with scientists. So we get stories that are working with new, real-world, exciting research that's actually going on and hopefully generating some new topics. There are some people who want to deal with older tropes, but we're also getting some brand new stuff in there too. And that's going to be, that's in hand, and all the writers have met their scientists, and hope to get the stories all in November, December, get the book out in spring.
You know, I was reading on your website about mundane science fiction, and this obviously reminds me of that. But for listeners who aren't familiar with the term, can you explain what mundane SF is?
I guess mundane SF, it thinks for most of us the future will be here on Earth. Many of us feel that there's pretty good technical reasons why we may not get to another beautiful blue new world. Even if we get some distance into interstellar space, there's still going to be a horizon. We're very small creatures, and not much travels between star systems. So it privileges Earth, and to do that, like Dogma filmmaking, it said, here's some tropes that we just us, we're not saying anybody else has to do it. When we write a mundane story, we agree not to have faster than light travel, we agree not to have very fast travel without time dilation, we agree not to have people traveling through time, we agree not to have people traveling between parallel worlds, we don't have telepathy. And the idea is that we ease people into writing new kinds of stories with new kinds of tropes. We had a mundane special issue of Inner Zone, which is the British science fiction magazine, all mundane stories, lovely stories by Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, Elizabeth von Arburg, who's a great Canadian science fiction writer, francophone, but writes superbly well in English as well, and some new writers, some of them Clarion, because actually, mundanity came out of Clarion. It came out of two different Clarions, particularly the 2002 workshop in Lansing, and it's still going strong, Trent and Julian and those guys, and the mundane special issue provided which it always sort of was meant to, of a publication venue for writers like Anil Menon and Bob Angel, who were, you know, Clarion people who were kind of caught up in the mundane thing too.
Yeah. Is it possible to have mundane space opera? or mundane mixing with the other
mundane space opera somewhere near Jupiter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. As long as you don't, we're very worried about aliens. If we can't get to them, they might not get to us. But you could have, two rival factions having disagreements in space. You could have a story, I think, in which, you know, somebody is traveling very fast and has time dilation on their side, helping them get out to Gliese, let's say, an Earth-type planet, to look at it. But by and large, the other thing we wanted to do back in 2002 especially, we felt that a lot of science fiction wasn't really looking at climate change and peak oil in the face either, and that there was this huge social change coming our way from that. That maybe we're missing somewhat like the information revolution, which we missed until it happened. And there was a feeling that we'd do a lot on that score as well.
So would you say some of Kim Stanley Robinson's work then falls into mundane science fiction?
I wouldn't, because stuff. He wouldn't.
Ah.
You have to agree to play the game. And the only person who can... A writer cannot be a mundane. Only stories can be mundane. And the writer decides it's going to be a mundane story by playing the game, and the only person who can say for sure if it is the author. If it came out before the game was played, or the author was already doing it without playing the game, you know, I wouldn't want to co-opt him, you know.
Yeah.
He's a great guy, and he's written great books, and yes, I mean, certainly 40 Days of Rain, those kind of books are books that we look to and admire.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the origins of mundanity was what's good. Now, we found that Philip K. Dick, Kim Stanley Robinson, and J.G. Ballard tended to have certain things in common.
Yeah. Now, what are some of your favorite subgenres of science fiction and fantasy?
I'm looking perplexed because I'm not sure I do the whole definition thing. Well, definition, yes. Description, yes. Classification, I mostly get tired, so I don't do it much. And the arguments where people get their panties in a twist trying to figure out, is this dark urban fantasy or I just don't care. I'm intrigued by, for instance, the kind of thing Jeff is talking about with mundane science fiction, where a certain amount of limitation actually pushes your creativity, pushes your... I love the idea that we don't get an easy out, because we don't have an easy out. I love the idea that, you know, of science fiction that doesn't say, oh, let's burn our bridge right here because there'll be another bright blue thing over there. I also love the science fiction that does give us what would it be like if we were able to move beyond. I just prefer that there be a very wide range and that there is a certain amount of reality that looks at how the world works, at how people work, at the things we are doing in our own nest. And says, how might we address this? Don't know if that's an answer, but
I think that's response. An answer.
Yes.
Well, we are running out of time, and I know it goes by fast, doesn't it?
It does.
Jeff's very sad. We can do this again sometime, Jeff.
We'll still be here.
You will.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll have the songs ready next time.
Yes.
The songs.
Oh, yeah.
Same
oh,
bat
yeah.
time.
Oh, well, I may have to come out for that. I really appreciate you taking the time for the interview. I know it's the end of the week. I want to give each of you a chance to mention something that you wanted to mention that I failed to ask, or final thoughts.
Come to Clarion.
Yes, because you know, we can't all blog about it, so apply.
But they will all blog about it. All right, well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And we'll be back with more show right after this. In space, spinning out of control, and on a collision course with the sun,
the crew of the spacecraft Corvus is about to discover something that will shatter everything they hold dear and call into question everyone they trust. Murder. From Stephen Ewan Cobb, Parsec Award-winning producer of the Future and You podcast, comes a science fiction thriller that will make you question everything. Find Bones Burnt Black at your favorite online retailer or at your local bookstore. And visit the author's website at stevecobb.com. Bones Burnt Black by Stephen Ewan Cobb. If space doesn't kill you, someone you trust will.
Hi, this is Brenda Cooper, author of The Silver Ship in the Sea and Reading the Wind, here to present the publishing key number 3, balancing writing and the day job. So let's start with some context. Here's what I do. I'm the chief information officer for the city of Kirkland, which is a medium-sized city near Seattle. So I have about 20 staff. I give speeches about the future at business events and write nonfiction articles. I have a family and 3 dogs. I do half marathon walks, and I write about a book and a half a year and a handful of stories. So first, I didn't make the title quite right when I said writing in the day job. It's actually important that you balance writing, your day job, and your life. Now, balance to me isn't endure, even though maybe some days it feels like that. But why not really like all 3? So you'll probably feel like you're running a marathon, but you don't really have to hate every step. So let's take them one at a time. I've heard a theory that writers should have a dull and boring day job. My job's challenging, and sometimes it's more than 40 hours. But I get a lot of my ideas from the things that happen at work. I think it's good to do something interesting and to work with smart people. You should at least like your day job. I mean, on the balance side, I suggest not having a 60-hour a week day job. I have some writing friends that do that, and that's a little tough. So there's sort of the day job. You want to like it, and you want it to be challenging. You also need a life. Maybe that's family, maybe that's friends, maybe it's a cause. You'll have less time for it than people who aren't also writing. But I've seen a lot of writers burn out when they always sacrifice the entertainment and the people they love for their writing. An early teacher of mine, who is the writer Stephen Barnes, taught me that some exercise is pretty good, too. If you mix that in, that'll help you have the energy to write, work, and love. I walk, do a boot camp class, and ride my bike. Now, writing really needs to be taken as a second job. What I do is I write a minimum of about 1,000 words a day, almost every day. That's about 4 pages, and it takes 1 or 2 hours a day. When I finish that, I stop feeling like I need to write more so that I can relax or I can engage fully with my family or my work or whatever else is pulling at me. It's also important to learn to write whenever you have time. Sometimes I get up early and write. Sometimes it's lunch. Sometimes it's on the way home, get a cup of tea at a Starbucks or something. I have my computer, and I have a journal with me all the time. So if I have an idea, I can write it down. If I have 15 minutes, I can sit and write a half a page. Learn tricks that work for you that sort of get you to do the writing. For me, that's deadlines, even if I give them to myself. Some of my friends like to blog their word count. Some like to be in online communities where they support each other. I'm not sure there's a right way, but it's pretty important to find something that's going to keep you writing. And lastly, if your work or your writing or your life kind of blows up on you from time to time, just write it out. Don't feel guilty about it, and then rebalance. For example, when I'm near the end of a book, I'm often just writing, and I really don't have time for much of anything else, or I take a day off work or whatever, because that's really what I need to do. But sometimes work gets in the way, and I can't write. And you just kind of have to write all of that stuff and then get yourself back into a balance so you're doing a little bit of all 3 most of the time. So that's it. Balance, an important key to writing. Thanks.
Thank you, Nalo and Jeff and Brenda, for being on the show, and I really had a great time hanging out with you guys, and thank you again for inviting me to have dinner with the students. That was a lot of fun. I had a really fun time with that. Hey, let's go ahead and get to some feedback, and first, a voicemail.
Yay!
Hi, guys. My name is Will Shattuck. I'm also known as Will the Computer Guy and a couple other podcast voicemail shows, but that's not the reason I'm calling. I just heard your first Clarion interview podcast with Kelly, and then the cover thing with Lou, and from Myrtle Lafferty's I Should Be Writing Feed. I just want to tell you I really appreciate you sharing your show with her. I did not know about you guys until this episode. I really appreciate it. I'm an aspiring writer, and I learned a lot just by listening to Kelly and where she was covering about all her stories. Anyway, my mouth is starting to tumble up all the time. Anyway, I just want to tell you thank you. It's been awesome. I'm going to subscribe to your feed. Take care, guys. Bye.
Well, hey, thank you, Murr, for playing the shows on your feed. And Will, we're happy to have you.
Yeah, absolutely, Will. Welcome to the chaos that is Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
It is an adventure, after all.
We hope you enjoy the sounds of our voices.
And we only have about 53 other hours that you can catch up on.
of me talking about nothing.
Yeah.
It's really awesome.
It's normally how it works. But hey, thanks, Murr, for helping us get the word of our show out to your audience. I mean, I've thanked her many times in emails and such, but it's been really cool. And she didn't have to do that. And
no,
I know
she
she's excited about the Clarion interviews, but it's really cool that she's doing that.
That is really cool. Yeah. Murr, you're my peeps.
That's right. All right, we got an email.
Lots of feedback this week. I like it. We have an email from Keith Latch, who writes in response to the print-on-demand versus podcast novel discussion we had in episode 55. He writes, "My first novel, A Ghost Story, was self-published in 2006. What a headache that was. I will probably never, ever do that again. Since then, I've been fortunate to team up with a quality small press publisher from Canada, Champagne Books. Unfortunately, they specialize in romance, and since I do not write romance, while the editing, cover art, and everything is top-notch, I haven't been able to get the distribution I would like. Now comes podcasting. With my new novel, Omega, Earth's Hero, I have a chance to reach untold numbers of potential listeners. It's not a way to make money, it's not even a means to an end. It's simply about telling a story and hoping someone connects with it. If not, it didn't cost them anything, and I still got to tell the story I wanted. Do I hope it's a success? Of course. Will I survive if it's not? Of course. Thanks to you both, and keep up the awesome job." Well, thank you, Keith, for emailing. And, yeah, I mean, you know, back to that podcasting discussion, podcasting your novel. If your main goal is to tell a story, it's just to tell a story that to share with people. It is a fabulous way because you can reach untold numbers. It's on the net. You know, you never mm-hmm. know what'll spread like wildfire. And I highly, highly recommend you do it. If it's your way to become a successful multimillionaire, crazy New York Times bestselling, you know, screaming fan author, I'm not sure about that. But, you know, you never know. It does sometimes happen. There are some authors out there that it's happened to. And, you know, I was hoping that you weren't taking what I was saying about that as a discouragement to people putting their novel in podcasting. Because if they want to tell a story to people, I totally encourage them to do that.
Right on.
Yeah. Makes sense.
I'm with you.
All right.
Yeah.
Power to the people.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you again, Keith, for emailing.
And that's the last email that we had. I've been saving that one for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Yay.
So that's going to wrap it up for this episode. Please listen to I Should Be Writing at ishouldbewriting.com for the keys to publishing numbers 2 and 4. 2 has already played. 4 will be playing soon. You can look up the story as a feature on Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing and see the list of for where the keys are if you want to catch up and participate in the contest. Only 2 more keys to go, so the Keys to Publishing contest will be wrapping up in a few weeks, and some of you are going to win some great books. Oh, and I got the Brenda Cooper book signed, by the way.
Cool. You can email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Or, of course, call the voicemail at 206-350-5029. And then we also have the new and improved website at adventuresinscifipublishing.com.
And still getting better. Yeah.
Yeah. If you do say so yourself,
if
yeah.
If I do, I don't know why I would think that. That's going to do it for us. We'll see you next week, hopefully with the Clarion students. I expect that we will be. And also with the Comic-Con content coming to the feed soon, so don't miss that. So until next time, thanks for listening.
And keep reading.
Music for Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing by Cargo Cult from their song Dirt. You can learn more about them at magnatune.com. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to a Singularity Audio production. To learn more, please visit www.singularityaudio.com.